Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Excuse me. Sorry, I started a few minutes late tonight. I'm trying to open up this chat, this new chat room here, and it's kind of bizarre. You can hold on a second here. I don't know if I care for this thing so much, I kind of lose track of your switchboard. Yeah. Sorry. Tonight I was going to do a reading, and I kind of got to this a little late tonight. I had looked at a number of different things to read, and I kind of came across something that an Emersonian essay that I thought was very, very good. I haven't read it on the air before, and I've read it before, so it's not new to me, but it was quite a it's an eye opener. The essay is called Illusions, and it has to do with illusions, basically, and men's illusions, and we're quite. I should have bookmarked it, unfortunately I didn't. It's a very, very inspirational one. There's also another one that I really enjoyed, I thought of doing tonight, which is called The Spiritual Laws. But Illusions was very good as well. And I think I'll still do that one. It's a little shorter. Let me do this one. Illusions. I think you'll enjoy it. Second here, folks. We all have our illusions, and fortunately, they're not healthy. Some are, some are not, and unfortunately, the majority of them are not. And they are just illusions, but we're in the, I guess, the time warp that we live in. We're all subject to illusions, and unfortunately, they can cause us a lot of harm. But I don't know why. It's not on the page that I thought it was here. Just bear with me one more second here, folks, and I will have you. The book is broken down into... This is his complete works, and it's rather oddly set up. And it's book one and book two and so on. And Illusions is in volume three, 2003. So if you just bear with me, I will find it. Okay. the essay begins with a short poem that he wrote, and starts off the whole thing. And it states, and of course this again is called Illusions. Flow, flow, the waves hated, accursed, adored, the waves of mutation, no anchorage is. Sleep is not death, is not. Who seems to die, live. House you were born in, friends of your springtime, old man and young maid, day's toil and its guerdon, they are all vanishing, fleeing to fables, cannot be moored. See the stars through them, through treacherous marbles, know the stars yonder, star everlasting, are fugitive also, an amulet vaulted, the lambent heat lightning, and fireflies flight. When thou dost return on the waves' circulation, behold the shimmer, the wild dissipation, and out of endeavor to change and to flow, the gas becomes solid, and phantoms and nothings return to be things. An endless imbroglio is law and the world, then first shalt thou know that in the wild turmoil, horsed on the Proteus, thou ridest to power and to endurance. Some years ago, in company with an agreeable party, I spent a long summer day in exploring the Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. We traversed through spacious galleries, affording a solid masonry foundation for the town and county overhead. The 6 or 8 black miles from the mouth of the cavern to the innermost recesses which tourists visit, and a niche, our grotto, made of one seamless stalactite and called, I believe, Serena's Bower. I lost the light of one day. I saw high domes and bottomless pits, heard the voices of unseen waterfalls, paddled 3/4 of a mile into the deep Echo River, whose waters are peopled with the blind fish, crossed the streams, Leith and the Styx, plied with music and guns and echoes and with these alarming galleries, saw every form of stalagmite and stalactite in the sculptured and fretted chambers, icicle, orange flower, grapes and snowball. We shot Bengal lights into the vault and groins of the Sperry cathedrals and and examined all the masterpieces which the 4 combined engineers, water, limestone, gravitation, and time, could mark in the dark. The mysteries and scenery of the cave had the same dignity that belongs to all natural objects and which shames the fine things to which we foppishly compare them. I remarked especially the mimic habit with which nature, on new instruments, hums her old tunes, making night to mimic day and chemistry to ape vegetation. But I then took notice and still chiefly remember that the best thing which the cave had to offer was an illusion. On arriving at what is called the Star Chamber, our lamps were taken from us by the guide and extinguished or put aside, and on looking upwards I saw or seemed to see the night heaven thick with stars glimmering more or less brightly over our heads, and even when seemed a comet flaming among them. All the party were touched with astonishment and pleasure. Our musical friends sung and much feeling a pretty song, and the stars are in the quiet sky, and I sat down on the rocky floor to enjoy the serene picture, some crystal specks in the black ceiling high overhead reflecting the light of a half-hid lamp, yielding this magnificent effect. I did not like cave so well for eking out its sublimities with this theatrical trick, but I have had many experiences like it before and since, and we must be content to be pleased without too curiously analyzing the occasions. Our conversation with nature is not just what it seems. The cloud rack, the sunrise, and the sunset glories, rainbows, and northern lights are not quite so spherical as our childhood thought them. And the part our organization plays in them is too large. The senses interfere everywhere and mix their own structure with all they report of. Once we fancy the earth a plane and stationary. In admiring the sunset, we do not yet deduct the rounding, coordinating pictorial powers of the eye. The same interference from our organization creates the most of our pleasure and pain. Our first mistake is the belief that the circumstance gives the joy which we give to the circumstance. And something is happening. Second here, and okay. Sorry, I kind of lost my place here. Our conversation with nature is not just what it seems. I just passed that. The senses interfere everywhere and mix their own structure with all they report of. Once we fancy the earth a plane and stationary. In admiring the sunset, we do not yet deduct the rounding, coordinating pictorial power of the eye. The same interference from our organization creates the most of our pleasure and pain. Our first mistake is the belief that the circumstance gives the joy that we give to the circumstance. Life is an ecstasy. Life is sweet as nitrous oxide, and the fisherman dripping all day over a cold pond, the switchman at the railway intersection, the farmer in the field, the Negro in the rice swamp, the fop in the street, this hunter in the woods, the barrister with the jury, the bell at the ball, and all ascribe a certain pleasure to their employment, which they themselves give it. Health and appetite impart the sweetness to sugar, bread, and meat. We fancy that our civilization has got on far, but we still come back to our primers. We live by our imaginations, by our admirations, by our sentiments. The child walks amid heaps of illusions, which he does not like to have disturbed. The boy, how sweet to him is his fancy, how dear the story of barons and battles. What a hero he is, whilst he feeds on his heroes. What a debt is his to imaginative books. He has no better friends or influence than Scott, Shakespeare, Plutarch, and Homer. The man lives to other objects, but who dare affirm that they are more real. Even the prose of the streets is full of refractions. In the life of the dreariest alderman, fancy enters into all details and colors them with rosy hue. He imitates the air and actions of people whom he admires and is raised in his own eyes. He pays a debt quicker to a rich man than to a poor man. He wishes the bow and compliment of some leader in the state or in society, weighs what he says. Perhaps he never comes nearer to him for that, but dies at last better contented for his amusement of his eyes and his fancy. The world rolls, the din of life is never hushed. In London, in Paris, in Boston, in San Francisco, the carnival, the masquerade is at its height. Nobody drops his domino. The unities, the fictions of the piece it would be an impertinence to break. The chapter of fascinations is very long. Great is paint. Nay, God is the painter, and we rightly accuse the critic who destroys too many illusions. Society does not love its unmaskers. It was wittily, if somewhat bitterly, said by D'Albert. And he quotes French here, and I can't read French too well. I find men victims of illusion in all parts of life, and children, youths, adults, and old men, all are led by one bauble or another. Yoganidra, the goddess of illusion, Proteus or Momus or Gilthy, mocking. For the power has many names, is stronger than the Titan, stronger than Apollo. Few have overheard the gods or surprised their secret. Life is a succession of lessons which must be lived to be understood. All is riddle, and the key to a riddle is another riddle. There are as many pillows of illusion as flakes in a snowstorm. We wake from one dream into another. The toys, to be sure, are various and are graduated in refinement to the quality of the dupe. The intellectual man requires a fine bait. The sots are easily amused. But everybody is drugged with his own frenzy, and the pageant marches at all hours with music and banner and badge. That's so true. Everybody has their own illusions. And live within them to a large degree. And amid the joyous troops who give in to the chivalry, comes now and then a sad-eyed boy whose eyes lack the requisite refractions to clothe the show in due glory, and who is afflicted with a tendency to trance home the glittering miscellany of fruits and flowers to one root. Science is a search after identity, and the scientific whim is lurking in all corners. At the state fair, a friend of mine complained that all the varieties of fancy pears in our orchard seemed to have been selected by somebody who had a whim for a particular kind of pear and only cultivated such as had that perfume. They were all alike, and I remember the quarrel of another youth with the confectioners that when he racked his wit to choose the best confits in the shop, in all the endless varieties of sweetmeat, he could only find three flavors or two. What then? Pears and cakes are good for something. And because you unluckily have an eye or nose too keen, why need you spoil the comfort which the rest of us find in them? I knew a humorist who, in a good deal of rattle, had a grain or two of sense. He shocked the company by maintaining that the attributes of God were two, power and risibility, and that it was the duty of every pious man to keep up the comedy. And I have known gentlemen of great stake in the community, but whose sympathies were cold, presidents of colleges and governors and senators who held themselves bound to sign every temperance pledge and act with Bible societies and missions and peacemakers and cry, histaboy, to every good dog. We must not carry comedy too far, but we all have kind impulses in this direction. When the boys come into my yard to leave to gather horse chestnuts I own, I enter into nature's game, in effect to grant the permission reluctantly, fearing that any moment they will find out the imposture of that showy chaff. But this tenderness is quite unnecessary. The enchantments are laid on very thick. Their young life is thatched with them, bare and grim to tears and the lot of children in the hovel I say yesterday, yet not the less than hung it around with frippery and romance, like the children of the happiest fortune and talked of, the dear cottage where so many joyful hours had flown. Well, this thatching of hovels is the custom of the country. Women, more than all, are the element and kingdom of illusion. Being fascinated, they fascinate. They see through God, Lorraine's, and our dare, and how dare anyone, if he could, pluck away the coalesces, stage effects, and ceremonies by which they live. And too pathetic, too pitiable, is the region of affection and its atmosphere always liable to mirage. And I like that because it's so true. Women do live in a more, or try to live in a more, in illusions, in a more fantasy. And that's what gives us, that's what makes them so fascinating. We are not very much to blame for our bad marriages. We live amid hallucinations, and this special trap is laid to trip up our feet with, and all are tripped up first or last. But the Mighty Mother, who had been so sly with us, as if she felt that she owed us some indemnity, insinuates into the Pandora box of marriage some deep and serious benefits and some great joys. We find a delight in the beauty and happiness of children that makes the heart too big for the body. In the worst assorted connections, there is ever some mixture of true marriage. Teague and his jade get some just relations of mutual respect, kindly observation and fostering of each other, and learn something that would carry themselves wiselier if they were now to begin. 'Tis fine for us to point at one or another fine madman, as if there were any attempts. The scholar in his library is none. I, who have all my life heard my number of orations and debates, read poems and miscellaneous books, conversed with many geniuses, am still the victim of any new page. And if Marmaduke or Hugh or Moosehead or any other invent a new style or mythology, I fancy that the world will be all brave and right if dressed in these colors, which I had not thought of. Then at once I will daub with this new paint, but it will not stick. 'Tis like the cement which the peddler sells at the door. He makes a broken crockery hold with it, but you can never buy of him a bit of the cement which will make it hold when he is gone. And men who make themselves felt in the world avail themselves of a certain fate in their constitution which they know how to use. But they never deeply interest us unless they lift a corner of the curtain or betray never so slightly their penetration of what is behind it. 'Tis the charm of the practical men that outside of their practicality are certain poetry and play, as if they led the good horsepower by the bridle and preferred to walk, although they can ride so fiercely. Bonaparte is intellectual as well as Caesar. And the best soldiers, sea captains, and railway men have a gentleness when off duty, a good-natured admission that there are illusions, and who shall say that he is not their sport? We stigmatize the cast-iron fellows who cannot so detach themselves as dragon-ridden, thunder-stricken, and fools of fate with whatever powers endowed. Since our tuition is through emblems and indirections, 'tis well to know that there is method in it, a fixed scale, and rank above rank in the fantasisms. We begin low with coarse masks and rise to the most subtle and beautiful. The red men told Columbus they had an herb which took away fatigue, but he found the illusion of arriving from the east at the Indies more composing to his lofty spirit than any tobacco. Is not our fate in the impenetrability of matter more sedative than narcotics? You play with straw, with jack straws, balls, bowls, horse and gun, estates and politics, but there are finer games before you. Is not time a pretty toy? Life will show you masks that are worth all of your carnivals. Yonder mountain but migrate into your mind. The fine stardust and nebulous blur in Orion, the portentous year of Mizar and Alcor must come down and be dealt with in your household thought. What if you shall come to discern that the play and playground of all this pompous history are radiations from yourself, and that the sun borrows his beams? What terrible questions we are learning to ask. The former men believe in magic, by which temples, cities, and men were swallowed up, and all trace of them gone. We are coming on the secret of a magic which sweeps out all men's minds, all vestige of theism and beliefs which they and their fathers held and were framed upon. There are deceptions of the senses, deceptions of the passions, and structural beneficent illusions of sentiment and of intellect. There is the illusion of love, which attributes to the beloved person all which that person shares with his or her family, sex, age, or condition, nay, with the human mind itself. 'Tis these which the lover loves, and Anna Matilda gets the credit of them. As if one shut up always in a tower with one window, through which the face of the heaven and the earth could be seen, should fancy that all the marvels he beheld belonged to that window. And there is the illusion of time, which is very deep, who has disposed of it. Or come to the conviction that what seems the succession of thought is also, or rather is only, the distribution of wholes into causal series. The intellect sees that every atom carries the whole of nature, that the mind opens to omnipotence, that in the endless strivings and ascents, the metamorphosis is entire, so that the soul doth not know itself in its own act when that act is perfected. There is illusion that shall deceive even the elite, the elect. There is illusion that shall deceive even the performer of the miracle. Though he make his body, he denies that he makes it. Though the world exists from thought, thought is daunted in the presence of the world. And one after the other, we accept the mental laws, still resisting those which follow, which, however, must be accepted. But all our concessions only compel us to new profusion. And what avails it with that science has come to treat space and time as simply forms of thought, and the material world as hypothetical, and with all our pretension of posterity, and even of childhood, are fading with the rest, if at last even our thoughts are not finalities. But the incessant flowing and ascension reach these also, and each thought which yesterday was a finality, today is yielding to a larger generalization. With such volatile elements to work in, it's no wonder if our estimates are loose and floating. Must work in a firm, but we have no guess of value of what we say or do. The cloud is now as big as your hand, and now it covers a county. That story of Thor, who was set to drain the drinking horn in Asgard and to wrestle with the old woman and to run with the runner, Locke, presently found that he had been drinking up the sea and wrestling with time and racing with thought, describes us who are contending amid these seeming trifles with the supreme energies of nature. We fancy we have fallen into bad company and squalid conditions, low debts, shoe bills, broken glass to pay for, pots to buy, butchers, meats, sugar, milk, and coal. Set me some great task, ye gods, and I shall show my spirit. Not so, says the good heaven. Plod and plow, vamp your old coats and hats, weave a shoestring, and great affairs and the best wine by and by. Well, 'tis all fantasism, and if we weave a yard of tape in all humility, and as well as we can, long hereafter we shall see it was no cotton tape at all, but some galaxy we braided, and what the threads were, time and nature. to stop there for a second and grab that thought, because basically what he's saying is that nothing is lost. And we can create anything, I mean, from our imaginations. And there's nothing sadder in the world than a person without hope, or a child without hope, or a child without an illusion, a wish to be fulfilled. There's nothing sadder than someone without that hope or without joy. And so often, the illusions that we create do not necessarily have to be just illusions. They're ideas. And those ideas, being pleasant ideas or not, but what we fill our minds with, what we fill our thoughts with, be they a reflection of nature, they should be a reflection of what, of the good of nature, of the happy things, of the pleasant things, of the beauty, of the rainbows, of the moon, the sun, the green grass, the flowers, everything that's around us. And though they may be illusions, I think of them often in the wintertime of the garden. We have a very nice garden around this house, and a lot of perennials come up every year. But is it an illusion to think of them in the winter when all is white and dead and dormant? When I walk around my backyard or in the front yard and I look at the snow, feel the cold, I often think about the summer. And I think about, and I envision the flowers in the garden and the grass in the backyard and the front yard, and I think of friends who are coming over, and I think of enjoying my patio and enjoying people, enjoying that time. And when I forget, and as I fill my mind full of those thoughts, and yes, they're illusions because they were of the past and the future, definitely not the present, because the present is cold and dormant. But it fills my mind of this and gives me hope to look forward to the coming seasons, and allows me to plan for those, and allows me to think and to create those days in my mind when I'm sitting there cold and shivering and possibly. Cursing the weather, I can think of these things. But are they illusions? Yes. But will they be fulfilled? Yes, they do. They have. And in bigger and better ways. So are our illusions, can be dangerous, but I believe our illusions create our realities. Like, because what we dream first, we strive for. And if it's most pleasurable, then of course we strive for it even more so. We cannot write the order of the variable winds. How can we penetrate the law of our shifting moods and susceptibility? Yet they differ as all and nothing. Instead of the firmament of yesterday, which our eyes require, it is today an eggshell with coops, which coops us in. We cannot even see what or where our stars and destiny are. From day to day, the capital facts of human life are hidden from our eyes. And suddenly the mist rolls up that reveals them, and they then, how much good time is gone that might have been saved had any hint of these things been shown. A sudden rise in the road shows us the system of mountains and all the summits, which have yet just, which have been just as near as all the year, but quite out of mind. But these alternations are not without their order, and we are parties to our nation, to our various fortune. If life seem a succession of dreams, yet poetic justice is done in dreams also. The vision of good men are good. It is the undisciplined will that is whipped with bad thoughts and bad fortunes. When we break the laws, we lose our hold of the central reality. Like sick men in hospitals, we change only from bed to bed, from one folly to another, and it cannot signify much that becomes such castaways, wailing, stupid, comatose creatures, lifted from bed to bed, from the nothing of life to the nothing of death. In this kingdom of illusion, we grope eagerly for the stays and foundations. There is nothing but a strict and faithful dealing at home, and a severe barring out of all duplicity or illusion there. Whatever games are played with us, we must play no games with ourselves, but deal in our privacy with the last honesty and truth. I look upon the simple and childish virtues of veracity and honesty as the root of all that is sublime in character. Speak as you think, be what you are, pay your debts of all kinds. I prefer to be owned as sound and solvent, with my word as good as my bond, and to be what cannot be skipped or dissipated or undermined to all the éclat in the universe. This reality is the foundation of friendship, religion, poetry, and art. At the top or at the bottom of all illusions, I set the cheat, which still leads us to work and lives for appearances in spite of our conviction in all sane hours that it is what we really are that avails our friends with strangers and with fate or fortune. One would think from the talk of men that riches and poverty were a great matter, and our civilization mainly respects it. But the Indians say that they do not think the white man with his brow of care, always toiling, afraid of heat and cold, and keeping within doors, has any advantage of them. The permanent interest of every man is never to be in a thick or thin costume in our life. The life of all of us, identical. For we transcend the circumstance continually and taste the real quality of existence, as in our employments, which only differ in the manipulations, but express the same laws, or in our thoughts, which wear no silks and taste no ice creams. We see God face to face every hour and know the savor of nature. The early Greek philosophers, Heraclitus and Xenophanes, described their force on this problem of identity. Diogenes of Apollonia said that unless the atoms were made of one stuff, they could never blend and act with one another. But the Hindus, in their sacred writing, expressed the liveliest feeling both of the essential identity and of that illusion which they conceive variety to be. The notions, I am, and this is mine, which influence mankind, are but delusions of the mother of the world. Dispel, O Lord, of all creatures, the conceit of knowledge which proceeds from ignorance, and the beatitude of man they hold to lie in being freed from fascination. The intellect is stimulated by the statement of truth in a trope, and the will by clothing the laws of life in illusions. But the unities of truth and of right are not broken by the disguise. There need never be any confusion in these. In a crowded life of many parts and performers on a stage of nations, or in the obscurest hamlet in Maine or California, the same elements offer the same choices to each newcomer, and according to his election, he fixes his fortune in absolute nature. It could be hard to put more mental and moral philosophy than the Persians have known, have thrown into a sentence. That sentence is, "Fooled thou must be, the wisest of the wise, then be the fool of virtue, not of vice." There is no chance and no anarchy in the universe. All is system and gradation. Every god is there sitting in his sphere. The young mortal enters the hall of the firmament. There is he alone, with them alone, then pouring on him benedictions and gifts and beckoning him up to their homes. On the instant and incessantly fall snowstorms of illusions. He fancies himself in a vast crowd which sways this way and that, and whose movement and doings he must obey. He fancies himself poor, orphaned, or insignificant. The mad crowd drives hither and thither, now furiously commanding this thing to be done, and now that. What is he that he should resist their will and think or act for himself? Every moment, new changes and new showers of deceptions to baffle and distract him. And when by and by, for an instant, the air clears and the clouds lift a little, there are the gods still sitting around him on their thrones, they alone with him alone. And that's the end of that essay called Illusions. And we all live in illusions, and we all do, and that's good. That's good. I think it's good to some degree, but we also have to have one foot on the ground, one foot in the our head in the clouds and our feet on the ground. And if we do that, I think, and I believe that's what Emerson is saying, if we do that, then we will always be walking upwards and forwards, and we must satisfy the cosmic laws. And the cosmic laws and the spiritual law being that of always moving forward to the light, always moving forward to the better. It's not a problem to have dreams. It's not a problem to have fantasies. It's not a problem. As long as we are aware that we're here and now, and that we still have one foot on the ground, or both feet on the ground, and that's where we get lost, and that's where our greatest problems arise, because there are artificial illusions, if you will. I'm quoting that myself, because I think the artificial illusions are those that are created by others, those that aren't created from the center of our own experience. Illusions are being, I mean, there, it's an illusion if you can't sing and think you can be a singer. You know, I think we've all seen American Idol auditions. It's an illusion if you think that you can be an actor and you can't act. It's an illusion. It's a delusion, actually. And it's wrong, and it leads us astray, and it leads us to bitter disappointment, even though we strive our whole life to be one thing, even though it didn't please other people and to follow the paths of conformity and be so trite and accommodating, that, you know, we give up ourselves. It's like people do that in marriages. They do that in childbearing. They do that. I mean, they do it They do it as husbands and wives and children, to obey their parents or their grandparents, or to obey the, you know, or to obey the laws of the city or the laws of the state or country. We give up a lot of ourselves to that, but in many ways we do that because we understand that those that do are those that have their feet firmly planted in reality. Yes, I mean, I can go and rob a store, or I can go and, you know, try to jump off a, you know, 10-story building and think I can fly, but that ain't going to happen because the laws of the universe don't allow that to happen. I mean, not physically anyway. The spirit can do remarkable things. It can heal the body, it can heal its mind, it can heal others. But the body itself is centered within the, if you will, the illusion of life. And we have to respect that in order to live, and to live well and comfortably, and not violate those rights of others, and not to violate the laws of the land. We all violate laws to some degree, minor laws privately here and there, but in a public manner, we don't. You don't want to try to rob a store, or you don't want to try to, go 100 miles an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone. And you don't, these are things that you don't do, you don't want to do, because what will happen is you will hurt yourself or hurt somebody, or you are violating the natural order of things. And because of that, you'll fail eventually, and you will be forced into the, the prison of karma by doing that. But if you just go forward, and you can dream, and you can dream all day, but there has to be action behind your dream. You can dream that you want an ice cream cone, but you have to get up and go get it in the refrigerator, or go out and buy it or something. That's reality. Perhaps in 2012, once time and space are no longer an issue with us, maybe then we can manifest these things we want immediately without having to concern ourselves with space and time. But at the same time, and at that point, all that we desire will be ours. All, illusion will no longer be illusion. It will be reality, immediately, which is something to, we've spoken about on many of these our different programs, especially with George Dixon. And please join us tomorrow night, by the way, with George, as we discuss these areas a little further. But there's no question that illusions are just that, and they can be delusions if we don't keep our feet firmly planted. And boy, I'll tell you, I've had my share of times when I had great illusions that were delusions, And we're fooling ourselves, We want to fool ourselves because I don't know why. We just feel that it's better to dream that dream than it is to live in the reality that we exist in. But people have a tendency to dream only and not act upon those dreams. And, in other words, you can't win the lotto unless you buy a lotto ticket, right? But again, that's the power of illusion and the tragedy of delusion and the aspects of reality that we face. So in the 8 minutes that I have remaining, which I thought I would be able to do, I was going to bring this up tonight, and I didn't think I could fill an hour with it. But I felt it was rather important, because this, in some way, this is illusion creating illusion. And the occult symbols, and cult symbols and corporate logos. This is an article that I pulled up this week, and I was kind of fascinated by it. And it was it's by VigilantCitizen.com, VigilantCitizen.com. VigilantCitizen.com, citizen.com, and it's called The Occult Symbols and Corporate Logos. And it says, during the 20th century, urban environments got taken over by corporate logos, and studies have reported that an average person is exposed to about 1,000 logos a day. And few people, however, ponder on the symbolic meaning of these marketing tools and their occult origins. This article analyzes the esoteric origin of some well-known corporate logos. And these occult or esoteric symbols have a magical effect on people, and that's why they're used and used so often, the same ones. It's known by the occult. It's known by the corporations that design these logos. And it's known that these are powerful symbols. Think about where you encounter logos on an average day. They are on household items, on cars, clothes, TV ads, on billboards, on insignias, all over sporting events, and even this very page. Logos are one of these results of extensive studies funded by Rockefeller's Chicago School in cognitive sciences, neuropsychology, and biology. Those studies constitute the core of marketing, which create, by the way, I'm reading this, is because marketing is the whole concept of creating illusions, creating magic, creating the illusion of success, the illusion of need and wants and desires. Those studies constitute the core of marketing, a heavily funded field which keeps its findings totally secret from the general public. Why are the findings secret? Well, if you knew why marketing worked on you, you wouldn't fall for it anymore. The huge invisibility of corporate logos is also an opportunity for the elite to showcase their beliefs and their power. The same way occult symbols are inserted on buildings and signs, or sites rather, they are hidden in plain view on corporate logos. We will now explore the origins and meanings of the symbols used in logos, and this article will focus on the Wing Sun Disc, the Vesica Pisces, and the Rising Sun, and more articles will come dealing with more symbols. Now, this article also stated, which is something which was very much news to me, that Barack Obama is a 32nd degree Mason. Now, without going into what that means, many of you who are listening probably already know. And if that doesn't send a shiver up your spine, I don't know what does. The Winged Sun Disc. The ancient symbol is commonly associated with Egypt, although it was also used by Persians and Assyrians, and also by remote cultures in South America and Australia. It consists of the sun orb flanked by two wings. The Egyptians traditionally depicted two serpents on the wings, representing the goddess protecting Upper and Lower Egypt. And that's the goddess of Isis. Explains its mythological meaning. Horus, the virgin-born redeemer of the Egyptians, came into the world to destroy the enemies of the great god Ra. Therefore, Horus changed himself into the form of the winged sun disc and took with him the goddesses Nekhibet and Uatchit in the form of two serpents. successful war upon the enemies of Ra, Horus commanded Thoth, the god of secret wisdom, that the winged sun disk with the erect serpents should be brought into every sanctuary of the gods of the lands of the south and the north. And the author continues about symbolism, and the symbolic points in the foregoing legend are very old, for they belong to the earliest period in the winged disk, which is the hieroglyphic means to become, to be, and to create. This is the part of symbolic ornamentation of every temple. Become, to be, and to create. Displayed over every gate and doorway, and a symbol of the earliest expression of life after death that has reached our day. And again, that is to become, to be, and to create. And the symbolism is a representation of the ascension of the soul to the divine with the help of the serpents of wisdom and knowledge. That's the sun winged orb. And the meaning of the winged sun disk is this. It is the symbol of perfect aspiration towards the divine, a purification of the lower nature, and a final ascent into union with the One. Egyptians mystics used the winged sun for ritualistic magic and invocation. Emblematic of the element of air, this consists of a circle of solar-type disk enclosed by a pair of wings. In ritual magic, it is suspended over the altar in an easterly direction and used when invoking the protection and cooperation of the Sifes. Hope Murray, Practical Egyptian Magic. That's where that is from. And the winged sun is still being used today by groups like the Freemasons, the Theosophists, and the Rosicrucians. The winged globe is preeminently a Rosicrucian symbol, although the Illuminati may lay claim to it, and it may be admitted that it is of Egyptian origin. And the winged globe is the symbol of the perfected soul making its flight back to the source of its creation in the Elysian field beyond. So this ancient mystical and magical symbol representing the perfect soul has graced entrances for millenniums and is still being used for the same purpose. There's a picture here that the winged sun used on Rosicrucian and Masonic buildings. Okay. Chrysler uses the symbol of the winged disc, or the sun, the disc, sun disc, and the winged sun disc. And the Autumn Bentley uses it. Mini Cooper logo is also. Has that disc, that same logo. Harley Davidson has the winged logo. Aston Martin has the winged logo. Even Chevrolet has the their chevron is a variation of the sun disc. Southwest Airlines, right, is also a sun disc logo. And the V. Well, it's 9 o'clock and it stopped streaming, but. I'd like to go into this more tomorrow night, as we did. Maybe we can discuss these symbols with George, who's very, very up on these things, and see how they're being used to deceive us, basically, and manipulate our attentions toward toward these companies and their use of magic, if you will, to seduce us. And with that idea, I will leave you. And please join us Friday night for a completion of this topic, as well as further expansion into the esoteric. And I hope you enjoyed that essay on the illusions. And have a pleasant evening.